you're in the session entitled Genetic Erosion, and that's where you want to be. Hopefully I'll make it worth your while. I will give it my best shot anyway. Which means, Russ, you can roll the tape. I love saying that to him. And for the record, introduce myself. I'm Charles Lane, and title of the session is Earthwatch Genetic Erosion. And going to chat a little bit this morning. Actually, in an area that is somewhat out of my field per se, in that my formal training in biology in particular ended with my first trip out to go fossil hunting when I was in school. I started out as a biologist and rapidly discovered that it was a whole lot more fun hunting fossils out of the rocks than it was dissecting frogs in the laboratory. And I came to my senses, in a sense, and got out of biology just shortly before I was scheduled to take genetics, which suited me just fine. There's an interesting situation at the school which I teach. I'm the chairman of the Department of Geology at Hardin-Simmons University, which is in Abilene, Texas. But I got out of biology just before I got into genetics, and the genetics professor flunked out of geology and became a biologist, so we have a good time talking with one another. But I don't feel like I'm really straying very far afield in terms of what we want to talk about this morning, in that I'm something of a son of the soil, although my father carried the mail. I was born and raised and lived in a very small town on the northwestern plains of Kansas. And all those small communities out there are fundamentally agriculturally related. And as a kid, I grew up running through those vast seas of wheat that you grow on the plains of western Kansas. And basically, all through my high school and college years, I made my living and put myself through school by farming and ranching. And have a certain appreciation for the nature of agricultural practices in this country. And thought that I would tackle this subject today. It's one that is, of course, interrelated with lots of other environmental issues, some of which we've been talking about the last week or so. And it has to do with a certain separation that we have from where we once were. I don't see too many people in here younger than myself, so perhaps we can, if I start going through this, except for my daughter up there, if we go through this, maybe there's a certain empathy you can feel for this. In the 50s, as I was growing up in northwestern Kansas, one of the great remembrances of my life is my father's garden in the backyard, which took well over half of our backyard. And the fact that my father had us each responsible for one or more different types of things that we were raising in the backyard. And my father, once he got off work, went about 5 miles down the road to a friend's place, and he was a dairy farmer. And the strongest thing I can remember about my childhood and food is that maybe once a month we would go to the grocery store. Now, maybe once a month we would go down to the grocery store and stock up on some of those things that did not come out of our garden, did not come from the dairy, did not come off the farm. Anybody connect with that? Does that, who's totally divorced from that? I mean, other than my daughter, who's never seen her food except from the grocery store. Never had that sensation. You've never had that sensation?
No, except from the grocery store. Except a little garden.
No, we really did. We did not go to the grocery store but about once a month to pick up on groceries. And you know, I remember my mother canning things and putting them away in the winter, and had all this canned stuff, and picking up the eggs and the milk and all this stuff kind of on a weekly basis right off the farm. We just did not go to the grocery store very much. I want to kind of carry this theme of the grocery store along through the discussion today, because I think it it's telling. I think it provides us with a way to look at where we are now globally, in a sense, by thinking about our relationship to the grocery store. I will put forth a hypothesis for you early on that the connectedness to the grocery store is at its heart an interruption. It prohibits us from a real connection to the earth. You know, we've lost our straight ahead connection to the earth, and we've lost it at a very fundamental level of taking in food, right? The food that sustains us. And I think this is symptomatic of other and even larger problems. Let's start off, go back start of the 19th century, and pick up with an English economist, Thomas Malthus. Tell us about the Malthusian principle. What is the Malthusian principle? You shook your head yes. You set yourself up.
That population will increase exponentially, and eventually it will outgrow the carrying capacity of the environment that it's in.
Thomas Malthus, early in the 19th century, looked at increasing population rates, saw it to be an exponential growth rate, whereas the growth in food production, as he perceived at the time, was strictly a linear function. All right, if you're going to get mathematical about this kind of stuff, somebody left that one off, then you have an exponential curve, one that goes like this, and you have a linear curve, which is something that goes like this, say, then there's an area in here where you can't keep up. And this was called the Malthusian principle, and it was the Malthusian prediction early in the 19th century. And essentially it never came to pass. The reason it didn't come to pass is that throughout the course of the 19th century and into the 20th, we've managed to make our food production capability go up at a geometric rate as well. But at a certain cost. And some of the costs are very obvious, and for those of you who are daughters and sons of the soil as well, you've seen this in the form of large-scale agricultural practices where we constantly till the soil, break it up with discs, instead of some of the old practices of undercutting, which we're now starting around to come back to, as a matter of fact. But this has given us the Dust Bowl of the 30s and some of these sorts of things. You've seen it in more and more and more irrigation. And yesterday touched a little bit on the harms of over-irrigation and the salinization of soils that occurs. And more water, and you need to work the soil more. And virtually all of you are old enough to remember 1962 when Rachel Carson gave us Silent Spring, and the abundance of fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides have come out in order to make that geometric rise possible. You know, and we've made, in essence, kind of a Faustian bargain with this, because we have put ourselves in a position now where we have to really go to some extraordinary measures to make sure that this stuff stays on track, and that we can continue to produce enough food to keep up with an exponential growth rate in the human population. We should worry about our food supply But even more than our food supply, we should worry about what we can call our seed supply. That is where the real challenge to every one of us as a nation, as individuals, globally, is going to lie in the years to come. It is not so much the food supply, although that is an extraordinarily serious problem. It is the seed supply. It is the seed supply because what we are after is going to be preservation of germplasm. It has been called the stuff of life. All right, now be careful about shaking your head again. germplasm. Anybody want to take a stab at that? As he holds his head very still. Anybody want to take a stab at germplasm? Kind of a odd term. Mm-hmm. Now, do you want to take a stab since nobody else is going to pull you out of the fire?
The collection, the pool of DNA in any given species.
The germplasm in the seed is the genetic material, not only the genes, but the DNA, the stuff that controls the genes, that tells the genes what to do, in essence. The germplasm, the genetic material, is extraordinarily at risk and is a much more serious problem than the foodstuff itself. The thing about the germplasm and the genetic material is that the genetic material is what you use to counter the effects of things like blights, different kinds of blights on the plants, different kinds of pests, and also helps you accommodate climatic changes. The world's nurseries for germplasm, for the seed of life, actually only occur in a few places, which we'll come to in a moment. This is going to be part of the history lesson that I want to get into. The nurseries of the world that are nurseries for the germplasm, for the genetic material, are only found in a few places. And you might be surprised as to where they are, especially with respect to some of the things that you commonly think of when you think of your own foodstuffs. We're going to pick on coffee today, for example, since you're all good Lutherans, Scandinavian Lutherans, and can't get by without your coffee, right? We'll pick on that a little bit as well. But first, let me make a couple of points, and these are crucial to how the rest of the session goes. When you talk about biotechnology, and I've had some dealings with some of these folks, as a matter of fact, again, I'm stepping out, but I've had a few dealings with some biotechnology folks. Biotechnology is always at work trying to create new varieties of feedstock, right? So we can pick on wheat. I'm really familiar with wheat, so let's kind of pick on wheat. The biotechnology crowd is always busy trying to produce new strains of wheat, for example, right? All right, but the biotechnology people are working towards what? They are working towards maximum yield in wheat or whatever else, right? And they design these things not for great genetic diversity, but they design these things for very low genetic diversity. In fact, they're trying to stay away from genetic diversity. Genetic diversity does not allow for extraordinarily high yields from crops. And now, here's here's something to think about. I mean, you've heard of biotechnology, you've heard of genetic engineering, you've heard of all of these things, but you need to have an appreciation, I think, of where biotechnologists are going with it. Biotechnologists are not really in the business of protecting biodiversity per se. They're in the business of trying to maximize yields on whatever the substance is, maximize yields in terms of feeding the world's populations, among other things, and their focus is actually the opposite direction. Their focus is not to diversify the gene pool, but in fact to limit it. Okay? That's where biotechnology is taking us today. That's an important thing to think about, because when you reduce the gene pool and bring everything down to a smaller size, you dramatically increase the vulnerability of those crops, those plants, to whatever blight or pest or climatic change that you're looking towards. Okay, whatever comes down the pike to hit them. And what you do if you are a biotechnologist to try to counter that is you go back into nature's gene pool. You go back to nature to try and pick up on the genetic diversity and those characteristics that will help you counter the blight, wheat rust, pests, these kinds of things. When you emphasize something like maximum yield in wheat, you minimize the genetic diversity and you turn a moving target into a sitting one with respect to whatever agents are going to attack it. When you go, all right, now you're ready, we'll let you have at it again. When you become monocultural, now we've heard a lot about polyculturalism with respect to peoples, but anybody want to give him some relief on a definition for monocultural when we're talking about any kind of a plant community? Anybody want to take a stab at monocultural? You want to take a stab at monocultural just for...
Well, sure, there's one kind. Let me just bounce something off you. Since you mentioned grocery stores, so what I'm sitting here thinking is all the lettuce in the grocery store is iceberg lettuce. That's what it's been limited to. I mean, you can find a little red leaf or a little green leaf lettuce, but then all the red leaf lettuce is like all the other red leaf lettuce. And I know, looking at my seed catalog, that there's a zillion kinds of greens to like this. So monoculturalism is just saying, okay, it's iceberg lettuce that we're going to have, raise, concentrate on. Right?
That's it. I mean, what we are into, actually, all of you, who's all Northwesterners? Oregon, Washington. All of you Northwesterners, you've been fighting this battle all along anyway. I mean, when push comes to shove, what was the spotted owl really about? Was it really about the spotted owl?
No, it was about clear-cutting old growth.
It was about clear-cutting old growth forests. Well, and destroying the biodiversity. Iceberg lettuce, and as a matter of fact, I'll give you the list in a moment, but there is something that's called, what did they call that? It's from the UN, the United Nations International Board for Plant Genetic Resources. Believe it or not, there is such a thing. They have an endangered species list, and lettuce is on it, as a matter of fact, because we've become so monocultural about it. When you get monocultural and you reduce the variety in the gene pool, then the lettuce, in this case, is no longer a moving target. Picture several thousand strains of lettuce. Picture a particular blight or insect moving through several thousand strains of lettuce. They've got to move around to hit a particular type of lettuce target. When you go monocultural, and do iceberg lettuce, then that's a sitting duck. It is a sitting target just waiting to be attacked. And the speed and the veracity with which blights and pests will attack something like that is amazing. You can develop a brand new strain of lettuce, say, and if you get in a real monocultural mode about it, it may be under attack in only one or two growing seasons for something out where you're wanting to...
Well, I was just going to... It seems to me that the problem is even maybe greater in the sense that it's not just iceberg lettuce, it's one particular kind of iceberg lettuce, whereas iceberg lettuce originally came in a variety of of forms, shapes, and variations that were some vulnerable, some not to a given situation. And so we have narrowed it. It made the risk even greater.
Yeah, exactly. Our wheat crop, okay, United States wheat crop, the genetic pool in the United States wheat crop is based on just a handful of genes. It's not based on a handful of genes, and yet there are thousands of genetic varieties of wheat. Same with the corn. Okay, same thing with the corn, same thing with all these things that we go monocultural with, right? A point, there are two points I want to get to right here at this juncture before we move on, right? That I've tried to impress on you. One, biotechnology, the business of biotechnology, is not the business of looking to diversify the gene pool, right? That is not the business of biotechnology. If anything, it is to go the other way and to bring things down where there's only a very small gene pool. You're working with very selected genes, very select characteristics that you are after. All right. Sub-point to that, I'm actually making more than I wanted to. Sub-point to that is that turns an otherwise moving target into a sitting duck with respect to things that will attack it. All right. Now, my other big point is that if you go to do something about that and wish to bring in the genetic diversity you need to protect that particular strain of wheat or lettuce or whatever, you go to nature to do it. Natural nurseries, nature's natural nurseries, yeah, that'll work, are the places where the gene pool diversity is. It's not in the laboratories. It is not in the laboratories, it is in nature. Okay? All right, that's the other point I wanted to come to. Now, let's see if I can stretch even a little farther with this one. Let me throw this name up for you. Heard of Babylonian centers. Even got you on that one. Anybody heard of Babylonian centers?
Centers, I've heard of.
sounds like an institute in Russia someplace, as a matter of fact. I had no idea there'd be this many people here this morning. I knew I was up against 1492, so I only printed off a dozen of these, but I can make more. But if you would kind of share some of these with folks around you, you know, if you guys would take one and kind of look at it. You folks, and that leaves 10, see what you can do. See what you can do to kind of get that spread around the room. You would be surprised, perhaps, to learn that the Russians have been at this business for a very long time, and I would think that you could talk to most American ecologists and agrarian ecologists, and they would tell you that is in fact the case. The Soviets have been on top of this kind of thinking for at least 40 or 50 years before Americans have. And the concept of a Vavilovian center originated with a Russian geneticist, biologist, ecologist, Nikolai Ivanovich, meaning that his father's name was Ivan, Nikolai Ivanovich Vavilov, who worked during the first half of the century. Okay. This is his thesis. His thesis is that with respect to the food crops that sustain humanity, I mean on a global scale, the food crops that sustain humanity have their nurseries, have their places of origin, their natural setting, in only 12 areas of the world. Only 12 areas of the world, and that those 12 areas provide the some 130 different species, which isn't all that many actually, 130 different species of plants that civilization, human civilization, depends upon. Take a look at the United States. Not a particularly substantial contributor to this. In fact, let me tell you a little bit about wheat while you're looking at this thing. The nursery for wheat, the place where it first sprung up, a place where it has attained its greatest biodiversity, is in an area of northern Iraq, eastern Syria, and southern Turkey. How's this make you feel so far? Of all of the genetic information that is found in that region for wheat, all the vast storehouse of genetic information that's found there, we use about 10% of that genetic information in wheat production in this country. 10%. When you take the world's seed banks into account, there's approximately 30% of that information that can be found elsewhere in the world. Meaning that there is 60%, you know, nearly two-thirds of the germ plasm for wheat that is still located just in the nursery, just in the area of northern Iraq, southern Turkey, eastern Syria. Nearly two-thirds. And it's such a politically stable and wonderful place. Far away.
Are these by definition then wild areas? I mean areas where it grows wild?
These are areas where it grows wild. These are areas where the wheat still grows wild. There are a few places, and it's, you know, this wheat is part of the Mediterranean here that's on the list. There are still a few places where the wheat germ is occasionally picked up and looked at by botanists. Out of other areas of the Mediterranean, most noticeably the high country of Macedonia, northern Greece. But you know where they find it? They tend to go looking in graveyards. Mm-hmm. Well, nobody bothers. it's sort of like Andy Rooney. I don't know if you remember Andy Rooney a number of years ago on 60 Minutes, but his question was, why do they put fences up around graveyards? Because nobody that's in there is going to leave, and nobody's outside really wants to get in. And I thought it was really cute, but that's, they leave graveyards alone. And it's amazing where the ecological botanists have to go looking for some of this stuff. They found some strains of wheat in graveyards in Macedonia that grow no place else. But yes, this is the cradle. This is the nursery. This is where wheat grows and experiments and goes through genetic alterations. And 60% of the world's wheat germplasm is still there in a country occupied by the Kurds, who are sort of beset on all sides. Right? I mean, stop and think about it. How important is wheat to the economy of North America? And wheat is not indigenous here. Back to the example for all of you coffee drinkers. If you'll look down there where it says Brazil, Paraguay, notice that there are things like Brazil nuts, cocoa, cashew, cassava, the para rubber, which is another story we can get into, peanut and pineapple. Notice that coffee is not mentioned there. Jump past the United States to Ethiopia. Now, here's a story that is filled with irony. I mean, when you folks think about biodiversity being destroyed, probably the first thing that comes in your mind is the Amazon rainforest, right? Catches a lot of the world's media attention. So, over the past two decades, while this has been going on, Brazilian coffee growers have been going back and forth to Ethiopia to complain to Ethiopia about their destruction of their forests. No coincidence that the deforestation of Ethiopia, which has taken the forest from where it once occupied 40% of Ethiopia's land surface to now occupying less than 1% of Ethiopia's land surface. It's no real coincidence that that has coincided with desertification and famine in Ethiopia. There's no coincidence about that at all. But it's the highlands of Ethiopia that are home to coffee. That's home. Paraguay, Uruguay, Brazil, that's not home. That's not the nursery. And the Brazilians knew this. That's why they were going to Ethiopia to complain about Ethiopia destroying the nursery for coffee. As a matter of fact. Another story that comes to mind with respect to rice, which obviously is the major staple of a good portion of the world's diet. Late 70s, there was a blight attacking rice throughout Southeast Asia, China and Southeast Asia, threatening the rice crop and therefore threatening the lives of literally billions of people. And the International Rice Institute, which is in the Philippines, was busy looking through some 45 or 50,000 known strains of rice that were in their seed banks, trying to find a rice that was resistant to this particular blight and could not do it. Their answer, as is the answer for biotechnologists at large, was to go to nature and try and find some strain of rice that was in fact resistant to this particular blight. And they found it. They found it in a river valley in the upper part of the Indus system in India. Got it. Started breeding that into the rice through the late 70s. Averted the blight. 6 months after they physically went into India and picked this rice up and took it back to the Philippines to work with it, hydroelectric dam flooded the valley that the rice was in. The only known place this rice had come from. 6 months later, wouldn't have been there. Therefore, here we go. The United Nations International Board for Plant Genetic Resources. has taken a look at food crops they consider to be most at risk from what they call genetic erosion. Genetic erosion. The erosion or the diminution of genetic diversity in a species, that's what genetic erosion is, the diminution of genetic diversity. And here's the list. Apple, avocado, I'll come back to that because that's a real tragedy in my opinion. Barley, cabbage, cassava, chickpea, cocoa, coconut, coffee, eggplant, lentil, maize, mango, cantaloupe, okra, onion, pear, pepper, radish, rice, sorghum, soybean, spinach, squash, sugar beet, sugar cane, sweet potato, tomato, wheat, and yam.
Most of our staples.
Remember what it is that we're talking about here. We are not talking about the fact that this year there is not going to be enough wheat grown in this country. We're not talking about volumes of food here. We are talking about genetic erosion. We are talking about the dwindling genetic diversity of all of these different types of staple foods that we have. When you have genetic diversity decreasing, then your vulnerability to attack by blights and pests increases. When you reach a crossover point, that's it. You've lost it. You've lost the species. I mean, we're not talking here about things that we don't even know about, which we will. I mean, we can jump into biodiversity in the Amazon rainforest. We're talking about the food staples of the planet and the reduction of their biodiversity pool. And it ties back to what the Russians have been up to for a good long time, protection of these Vavilovian centers around the world, the 12 Vavilovian centers that I've identified there. If you take a careful look, you'll see a lot of them are in third world countries, right? I mean, we can protect the cranberry. And we can protect, and anybody who wants to help me out with this, feel free, we can protect the Jerusalem artichoke. I'm an artichoke fan, but what's a Jerusalem artichoke?
The tuber.
Is it?
Yeah.
The
tuber.
It
tastes like water
chestnut. Oh, does it? Oh, that'd be very good.
It has natural insulin.
I like that. But it's not really like a California artichoke?
No, it's kind of like that.
An enlarged ginger. I do like California artichokes. When I lived in California, I actually got used to having Canadian bacon and artichoke heart pizza.
Oh.
Very tasty. Very tasty. The thing about avocados brings another story to mind. This would have been early 70s. For those of you who are Californians, there was a blight that was breaking out in the California avocado industry. And the California avocado botanists actually went to Peru. No, not Peru, Ecuador. They went to Ecuador and found a strain of avocado there that could be crossbred that was resistant to the blight and saved California a lot of grief in the early 70s. The thing of it was is that it was 12 trees, 12 avocado trees that were just about set to be demolished for a new subdivision. And so in Ecuador. So the California avocados saved a serious blight by 12 avocado trees in Ecuador. Now, the list goes on and on and on. But you know, when you look at this thing and you see these lists of the Vavilovian centers, you see them in third world countries. And they're under population pressures. They aren't necessarily trusting of first world countries, and they're intense. That actually goes back a long ways, by the way. Anybody remember the story of how the British Empire got busily engaged in developing rubber plantations? Anybody into 19th century English history? Let me put this one on you. Rubber, if you take a look, you will find rubber in Brazil, Paraguay. That's the nursery, that's the cradle for rubber. The British rubber plantations were on what is now Sri Lanka, India, Burma, Thailand. Rubber tree was not indigenous to that part of the world. Didn't exist there until about the middle of the 1800s. Didn't exist there until the steamship came along. And it's the story of the British steamship that came to the mouth of the Amazon, steamed halfway up the Amazon River into the heart of Brazil. And in the 1850s, Brazil was making a real strong bid to be an economic player on the world market. Actually, may have, some historians think, been moving on its way to first world nation status as a result of their, in essence, monopoly on the rubber market. And English steamship sails halfway up the Amazon, stops at Manaus, M-A-N-A-U-S?
Manaus.
Which at the time was quite a thriving city, electrified, had an orchestra, had an opera, kind of a first world kind of place. And in the dead of night, steamed out again with some stolen rubber plants. And a portable terrarium, in essence, on board the steamship. And surprise, surprise, a few years later, there were rubber plants springing up all over Sri Lanka. With the English ability for transport already intact, and the rubber industry in Brazil kind of folded up in a hurry. So, you know, there's not a lot of love lost in that respect.
Rice is listed here primarily in the Indo-Burma,
right?
Southeast Asia,
right?
What is the relationship between this kind of rice and what we hear in, like, up in my country call wild rice?
That I don't know.
Wild rice is a grain.
It's a grain of some kind.
Definitely, it's a grain. I'm just wondering what the genetic linkage is. Is that wild rice that we grow in northern Canada, what you grow in northern Minnesota, in Maine, are there genetic cousins? Is one native?
I don't think they're related at all. My understanding is that it really is entirely different, and it's just called rice. I think that's what I've heard, that there isn't any relationship.
Well, yeah. I think aren't they a form of grass, same as a coconut tree?
Could be. I don't know, but I
palm trees are grass.
All rice is grass.
All rice is grass, just as all
yeah.
meat is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
but
and you're not asking the right person in that respect. As a botanist, I am not, and so I can't really address that one for you.
All I'm going on is that people will make comments. Well, it really shouldn't be called a rice because in Minnesota they say that because they are not very similar. It's not very authoritative.
But you're from Duluth. We'll take that.
Yeah.
Far away.
Yeah, I guess I don't see why this is all so much of a problem. Is it what's to keep say, Brazil, for example, from going to Ethiopia and finding a good few pieces of coffee seed and taking them back to Brazil and setting up a little area and say, this is our new Babylonian center. Is that a problem?
Why is it a problem for the USDA to set up basically Babylonian centers throughout the country? It's not been done.
It's not been done.
It's not been done. I mean, the USDA does not do that. I mean, forget Brazil and Ethiopia. You know, we're talking about the United States Department of Agriculture.
But you said Brazil is so unhappy with the Ethiopian.
Sure.
The simple answer.
Sure.
Except you said how many strains there were, and it was like 25,000 strains of, what was it, coffee or something?
The,
so
believe it or not, there are institutes for rice study, which are in the Philippines. There's an institute for potato study, which is actually in Peru, and which a few years ago was attacked and overrun by the Shining Path. The Shining Path overran the place. I mean, they knew what they were doing. They knew what was at stake there. Fortunately, they didn't do anything to the potatoes. They did kill one or two people and held the others for a while. But there are places like that. The Institute for Rice Studies in the Philippines, I think their catalog now runs to about 80,000 different varieties of rice. And they are desperately trying to do just what you suggest. You know, they are trying to do that. But, I mean, do you see a national commitment on the part of the United States to do something like that? I mean, it's not there.
Can you talk about the biodiversity, what you know about the biodiversity treaty that we refused to sign at Brazil? Is it directly linked to this?
Anybody else want to take a stab at why we refused to sign the biodiversity treaty in Brazil?
It cost too much.
Because we're damn fools.
All right. Basically, we refused to sign the biodiversity treaty because we wanted to protect patent rights of American biotechnical companies. Yeah. That really, the bottom line is the bottom line. We refused to sign that because it would not give us exclusive patent rights with our biotechnical firms if we had signed the biodiversity treaty, which would have meant a global type of process. You know, the thing that started that kind of mindset, I think, the U.S. against the world kind of mindset, actually predates that. I think it goes back to something that was called the Treaty of the Sea. Does that ring any bells for anybody? Okay. Treaty of the Sea was an attempt a number of years back to have a systematic way in which all nations of the world could participate in the mining of the ocean floor, basically outside everybody's continental shelf, their continental limits. In other words, lots of manganese nodules that are formed on the bottoms of the world's oceans. Say that you develop a technology to actually collect those manganese nodules, bring them back to the surface of the ocean, and then use them for manganese, which is a strategic metal. Okay. Now, number one, who do you think is going to develop the technology first? It's not going to be Suriname. Okay. All right. So the United States says, it's our technology. We'll go out and mine the open ocean. And Suriname says, but this is the open ocean. You know, this is not an inheritance of the United States. This is an inheritance of the people of the globe. And in essence, it pitted the United States on one side against the rest of the planet on the other. And that kind of thing has carried on. I mean, my personal opinion is that this biodiversity treaty in Rio is a stepchild of that kind of thinking.
Was that a pretty narrow treaty, do you think? Was it really was it more economic? I don't know. you know, we didn't hear a whole lot about all that was included in that.
Well, what we need to do is we need to go to Al Pitcher's sessions and ask Al, since he was there,
to
talk a little bit about the details. But I don't think it was a very good idea for us to back out of that, because it really, my understanding of it, it really was a global endeavor. It was an endeavor to try and protect biodiversity from a multinational perspective, and we just got into the country club version of republicanism when we decided we just had no interest in that.
Protecting business interests of the United States.
And from where I sit, it looks like we're just protecting the business interests of biotechnical engineering firms in this country. That's the only thing we're doing. Yes.
Well, you know, to speak to what this gentleman was saying before, I know nothing about any of this, but just looking at your centers here and what the United States has indigenous to it right now, to me, it spells crisis, because yes, Brazil is saying, no, Ethiopia, you better do something, we're getting in trouble here with the coffee. However, what is the United States always doing? We are saying, Brazil, you know, you can't cut down the rainforest. You know, we're saying, you can't, to every other country, you have to leave these, you know, virgin territories for what we need. However, how about the economy of these third world countries and their population? And, you know, as they become more technological, what are happening? I mean, I think we're busy saying, don't do this, you guys, but we're not taking care, you know, to foster things in our own nation. I think that, you know, it doesn't look to me that seed banks are what we're really interested in stockpiling here.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. The sad truth of the matter is that when we talk about seed banks around the world that are trying to protect this biodiversity, a sizable minority of them are actually in private hands. They're private hobbyists. They're involved in this. There are other nations that have this as a national agenda and a national goal. And it's not on our agenda. You know, it simply is not on our agenda to be involved in that.
It's not up there with the defense budget.
It is just not on the agenda at all. I mean, and interestingly enough, it has been on other nations' agendas for a certain amount of time. Even, believe it or not, the Soviet agenda. I mean, you think about the environmental horrors in the Soviet Union, and you think about economic development at all costs. But remember, Vavilov that was the architect of this back early in this century, and there's actually been a fair amount of effort the Soviets have put out to handle this problem. Let me take a page here out of Al Gore's book. This is the one that Al Pitcher was hawking the other day at breakfast. This is Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit, Al Gore's book. Let me read something to you here. It's in his chapter entitled A New Common Purpose. And he's talking about the Nazi siege of Leningrad. Okay, some of you remember that story. The winter of 42, horrible winter, in a horrible place to have a horrible winter, in Leningrad. Anyway, let me read this to you. In the winter of 1942, the city of Leningrad was under siege, surrounded by Nazi tanks. For 900 horrifying days, the citizens endured artillery fire and aerial bombardment. But the worst was starvation. Before the blockade lifted, it had caused more than 600,000 men and women and children to starve to death. Those who survived ate sawdust, rats, grass, anything they could find. At Leningrad's Vavilov Institute, a botanical and agricultural research center, 31 scientists remained to guard the unique collection of plants and seeds gathered meticulously from their places of genetic origin, Vavilovian centers, all over the world, under the direction of the legendary biologist, geneticist, and plant explorer Nikolai Ivanovich Vavilov. Vavilov's colleagues, Vavilov himself, had been imprisoned by Stalinists for the sabotage of agriculture. Sounds pretty typical. Were less concerned about the expansion of Nazi Germany or Stalin's expanding gulag than about the expansion of industrial civilization into those areas of the natural world that contained the unique genetic resources that govern the world's food supply and genetic diversity. This is December of 1942. Because these areas were under a siege of their own, the specimens at the Institute represented for many species of food crops the only remaining link between the past and the future. Yet even during the bombardment of Leningrad, Vavilov's colleagues bravely planted new generations of crops in order to freshen their genetic stock. And when the hungry rats learned to knock the metal boxes of seeds off the shelves to get to the contents, the scientists took turns standing watch to protect their genetic treasures. Surrounded by edible seeds and sacks of plants such as rice and potatoes, 14 of the scientists died of starvation in December. Dr. Dmitry S. Ivanov, the Institute's rice specialist, was surrounded by bags of rice when he was found dead at his desk. 1942. You know, so I can't answer your question. You know, I cannot answer your question. It is simply not on this country's agenda. The USDA does not do this. But in part, you know, it may be a thing of we have, in essence, been kind of cut off. Our technology, in a sense, has cut us off. And I come back around now to the food market thing again. You know, my daughter sitting up there has never been in a position other than to go to the food market to obtain food. My youngest daughter, it's even worse because when we're out of money, she says, well, just go to the drive-in teller. We haven't been able to explain to her how that works yet, and I'm a little frustrated by it. But, you know, as I was reading and getting ready for this, the thing that kept flashing back into my head was the days of my youth in the 50s when the supermarket was a once-a-month kind of thing. And I realized, you know, I've been cut off. And when you are cut off, you know, you tend to trivialize the consequences of what you do with respect to the thing that has been cut off. So we're talking about genetic erosion.
I guess, you know, I'm an American citizen, but living in Canada has given me some very unique perspectives, which I never thought I would get on my own country. And sitting in the middle of Saskatchewan is this whole Rio event kind of happened. And listening to the Canadian media and the British media report on what was going on there, the image came across very, very clearly of the United States isolating itself from the entire world. Both Canada and Mexico signed the treaty without hesitation. Brian Mulroney was one of the main proponents of the treaty to begin with.
Not exactly Mr. Environment in Canada either.
Not at all, but Canada is deeply concerned in this issue. They have established this idea of, the image that came across was very much of the bully in the schoolyard. You know, the grade 12 kid in a classroom of kids who are only 6 years old, kind of bashing about. It's rather frightening.
And it was interesting on public radio in the United States, Mulroney's support was very well documented, so the image in the United States was kind of this distance. But, you know, even if you weren't concerned about some of the issues, it was why are these people who usually have seemed to be on the same wavelength so in such a different place than we are? So it came across there too, if you were listening. He was poor. He was very direct on how he felt about it.
There's, you know, some of you may have gone and seen Sean Connery in Medicine Man. It was very much a political statement. My wife went to see it because Sean Connery was in it, but. It was about, we must save the unknown precisely because it is unknown. And Sean Connery discovered a cure for all forms of cancer deep in the Amazon rainforest. But, you know, hopefully this kind of discussion this morning brings us a little closer to home. I mean, we're dealing here with the known. We're dealing here with just the fundamental foodstuffs that fuel the human population. And with respect to gene erosion and genetic diversity, virtually all of the foodstuffs that we have are at risk. So it's time to write the USDA, right? Certainly those kinds of things can happen. I mean, you folks in Washington and Oregon know this story already. I mean, you fought the fight with the spotted owl. I mean, you used the spotted owl, but preventing clear cutting of the forest is what you're after. Protecting genetic diversity is what you're accomplishing.
I don't think it's a clear cut. It's the speed of cutting. We're probably cutting them 5 times too fast. More than what the tree would grow, so you get another one to cut.
But you've got to avoid monocultural growth too. In that, I mean, getting several forms of trees to grow back.
Well, yes and no. Some of them don't grow.
Yeah, well, that's true too. But when I was in school, and I won't keep anybody who's got to go have lunch. Thanks for coming. Appreciate that. When I was at school at Northern Arizona, I mean, we're the Northern Arizona Lumberjacks. Yeah,
this of course, you're in the pine.
Yeah. Fir won't grow there.
Yeah.
Okay, go get it, Dave. But, I mean, I was at Northern Arizona 20 years ago. We're the Lumberjacks. I mean, forestry was the big thing.
Yeah.
And the curriculum was based upon monocultural stands of wood are good. I mean, that was the whole thinking. Monocultural stands of wood are good because we just mow them down and grow them right back up, you know, all sorts of stuff. Without thinking for the implications of what a blight of some kind would do or a certain type of pest would do and how vulnerable those things are to a certain blight or a certain pest. And, you know, then you're talking about economic devastation.
You got to remember that all these blights are inventing new kinds. New strains to better eat your tree.
And that's all the more reason why you want to stay away from